Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. Welcome to the show. So glad you guys could tune in tonight. We've just flipped the calendar day to the first day of summer a couple days ago, and we're definitely feeling it here, but ready to kick off a new season, at least here. I realize some of you are just going into fall where we broadcast, and frankly, I'd rather have your temperature, but in any case, thanks for being here. For those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a We Recovery program because it is in the We that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice. I'm really excited about our guest tonight. As many of you know, we have survivor stories, caregiver stories, alternative and holistic treatment stories, experts that are on in the medical field, and otherwise, alternatives to that. I know a number of people who have come through their brain injuries and talked about being more intuitive or more sensitive. Tonight, we have somebody who's really evolved in that way. My guest tonight is Courtney Marcassani. Let me do that. My mother's part of the family is Italian. I'm just going to guess that maybe. Now a coach, teacher, and health advocate with a master's degree in mind-body medicine, Courtney has spent the last 20 years passionately exploring the research gap that exists between what medical science believes and what the gifted sensitive feels. She provides us an enlightening ride through early to now emerging science on sensitivity and the abilities of the highly sensitive. Discover what type of sensitive you are with interpretation of what this means for you today. In her extraordinary new book, Four Gifts of the Highly Sensitive, Embrace the Science of Sensitivity, Heal Away Anxiety and Relationships, and Connect Deeply with Your World, Marcassani destigmatizes the term sensitive, illustrating how sensitivity is a powerful advantage and provides a pathway to an effective balancing act between being highly aware and participating fully in the world, without feeling the need to shut down or self-anesthetize to avoid pain, people, or environmental stimulation. And those are some things that have been prevalent in the brain injury community or during the pandemic or any time you have a major change in your life where that life on life's terms I was just talking about, when it doesn't come easy. Often we find ourselves going down a negative path that just makes our burden even heavier. We think we're going to relieve it, but we don't. We actually dig a deeper hole for ourselves. And so tonight I thought it would be really refreshing to talk about a different kind of medicine, because the other thing we talk a lot about on here is the level of dissatisfaction that our survivors have in what I call the traditional medical model. We've all talked about hoping it will evolve into something more integrative, and we're always looking for alternate ways to get help, alternative people who are practicing alternative ways of giving help, because the first line of defense, unfortunately, in our country is pill pelting. And if we don't want to self-anesthetize, we don't necessarily want the medical professionals to do that either. Maybe we want to feel it, deal with it, and come out the other side. For more on Courtney, and then I'm going to bring her on, you can check out her website at thewellnessuniverse.com/world/changers/Courtney Marchesani. And again, that's M-A-R-C-H, like March, E-S-A-N-I. For those of you who are familiar, you know that I always put the website in my program notes. And so we'll repeat it a couple times during the show, but you won't have to go back and re-listen to the whole show to find that website in my program notes. So with that, I am going to bring on Courtney. Courtney, welcome to the show. How are you doing this evening?
Hi, I'm doing really well. What an introduction. Thank you so much for sharing my bio and my work.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. I'm happy to have you here tonight. Sorry, I'm dropping my paperwork all over the place. I blew a word, audience. Let me go back and say, four gifts of the highly sensitive. Embrace the science of sensitivity, heal anxiety in relationships, and connect deeply with your world is the name of the book. So, again, you can find in my program notes the website. But, Courtney, so tell me, let's go back to the beginning and tell me how you came to find out about your gift or what was going on in your life prior to you tapping into this area and expanding on it.
Well, it was a deeply personal experience that shifted my awareness about intuition. That was the first experience that I had that was just a marked shift in my perception. That's the only way I could describe it. I had dreams that were precognitive or prophetic is another way to describe them. One of them was about an individual who was dangerous. I saw him in a dream run through a stop sign and got, you know, pulled over by the police, and his trunk was opened up in the dream, and he had a whole bunch of, you know, he was trafficking essentially. And I knew this individual through my husband at the time, and I woke up from it. I mean, I had also seen him in front of a judge, shackled with handcuffs, and he was being sentenced. And I woke up from that, and I was jarred very alerted
wow.
to the fact that, yeah, he was going to get in trouble. So I warned my husband at the time. I said, you need to be careful of this person. Please don't bring him around our family. I don't want you to be connected with him anymore. And he basically said, you know, you're paranoid multiple times. You're just being paranoid, just being paranoid. I mean, I know he was trying to reassure me. That was his way of trying to reassure me. But, and, you know, I'm not connected with him like that anymore, things like that. And then a month later, we saw the exact situation play out on the nightly news. It was in Missoula, Montana. We were both going to college at the local university there, and we saw him, the guy in my dream. And one part of it where he was in front of the judge with his handcuffs behind his back actually happened exactly as it did in the dream. So that was the first literal wake-up call for me to say something is happening. I didn't exactly know what it was. I didn't have words for it. I didn't know what to call it, but it was a warning. It was a very clear warning, danger. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, not good. And so then later, a couple years later, I went through a divorce, and I was a single mom at the time. And I was working at Harborview Medical Center, which is a trauma center in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle, Washington. Very busy. I had a very busy life. And one of my girlfriends asked me to move a bed for her. It was one of our other girlfriends' beds. And they were going to move in together and save money and move to New York together. So I said, okay, sure, I'll help move the bed. It was on a Saturday night, and I went over to my friend Rebecca's apartment to pick up her and her two young boys, and we drove across town to, you know, move this bed for our other friend, and her name was Amy. Amy got off work at 8 o'clock, so we met up, but as soon as I stopped at Rebecca's apartment, I felt the sense in my whole body, a very visceral feeling, that I shouldn't move the bed. And I actually heard those words and passed through my mind, my thoughts, don't move the bed. And I didn't know what to think. I felt like, well, that's weird. But I just drove away from the curb with Rebecca and the boys in tow, and we drove across town. But as I did through the whole drive, I just felt this sickening feeling like I should go back and not move the bed. And I actually said that to Rebecca as I was driving. I voiced it. I said, I feel like we shouldn't move the bed tonight. And she said, I'm sorry that we inconvenienced you. Well, I feel really bad about it, but let's just get it done. Let's just get it done. And so I was like, all right. So I pushed through the thoughts and I pushed down the thoughts. And we got to Amy's. She was off work. She buzzed us up. We went into her apartment and I started moving everything and taking the bed apart. I had all my tools and everything on the floor in pieces, getting ready to load it into the back of the truck. And I just dropped. I dropped the posts, and the mantle or the frame. And I looked at Amy and I said, I feel like we should go back right now and not move the bed. And Amy was like, Courtney, she was very forgiving. She was like, that's okay. Come back tomorrow. We'll finish up the job. And I just busted a move. Rebecca got back in the truck with the two boys and she looked at me and she said, now you're starting to scare me. And I said, well, I just feel like we need to go back. And so we did. I drove across town. We went back to her apartment. It seemed crazy at the time and nonsensical. But I felt that urgency to get back. And so when we did, we went up to the second floor where her studio apartment was, you know, on that second floor landing. And it was filled with a light smoke. It was a very light smoke.
Wow.
And so she was fishing for her keys in her purse, you know, digging for them, kind of panicking. And I asked her, you know, did you leave the oven on? Were you cooking cookies? And she said, no. And so she starts to get really scared too. And she put the keys in the door and we went in and I saw immediately that there was a river of wax from a 3-wick candle that was left burning. And the wax ran all the way across the living room floor and right in front of the door. And it was about a half inch of hardened wax.
God.
So, yeah, I went into the kitchen and I didn't know what to think. It was obvious that we arrived just in the nick of time. And then Rebecca's boys started screaming. And the apartment was a very small studio apartment. And the whole apartment building was really not very big. So I was shushing them to quiet down. You know, we made it in time. There was nothing to worry about. And then Rebecca said, no, come and look. And so I went over to see what the boys were pointing at. And they were pointing at a big black singe mark that was growing. And it was smoking. That's what was smoking and was filling the hallway and the corridor with smoke. It was this bamboo light shade cover over the windows. And that was just above the three-wick candle. And it was about ready to start on fire. And so we got there in the nick of time. And when that happened, that was what started me on the trail, on the path to try to understand what that experience was. It was life-changing. And I wasn't the same after it happened. Something inside me changed. And I wanted to research and figure out what it was. And so that led to all my research that I've been doing over the last 20 years and to the book, Four Gifts of the Highly Sensitive.
Let me ask you a question. Did you have, you started with the dream, which I'd like to know how your husband reacted when that dream, Miss Paranoia, played out on TV. but that's actually not my question yet. I was going to go back just a little bit further and say, that's where you start. But did you have any feelings, or were you aware of any feelings like as a kid of being more sensitive or intuitive, or did this actually start with that premonition really in a dream of something that was going to wind up being a reality? Was, and that you said you were like in college, is that really when you noticed it for the first time, because that was such a strong pull in that dream, and then that it wound up actually coming to fruition?
It's a really good question. The earliest memories I have that I can point to in my own subjective memory, and from, you know, being... in my family, is the differences between my family and myself. And so I did notice that I would always shy away from group settings. We would go over to my aunt and uncle's house on the weekends because they lived nearby on the family farm. And when I would go into the house, I would hide behind my mother's legs and feel a sense of strong trepidation about being in the room with other people. And so I would hide behind her legs, or I'd hide in the hallway, in a closet, I mean, in boxes. And so the thing that I remember early on that was unusual, that kind of set me apart from other members of my family, is that I was very reticent to be around others. I definitely also had visionary dreams that I communicated with my sister. She was 6 years older than I was, and I relied on her for her support, because I would say, do you have these experiences? And she said, no, not really. I mean, sometimes. So I did inquire when I was young, very young, about these situations, but I didn't understand them, and I didn't know I was any different. I mean, obviously, it was obvious I was different because I was very shy and quiet. And my mom said I barely talked at all, that I didn't communicate at all. I really didn't speak. And so together over the years and connected it to childhood, but I'd never had the profound insights, I would say, or the ability to connect them like I did when I was in college in my 20s. And they really started to expand. My awareness started to expand, and I noticed it. Not only did I notice it, you know, in the situation with the guy who drove through the stop sign, and also with the fire, those were life-saving situations, you know, or prevention of harm, I guess would be the better way to put
it. Yes.
So those really altered my perception about reality and what was possible through perception, which I didn't have that when I was a kid. Definitely not.
Interesting. Okay, now what did your husband say when that came to fruition? You said he was an ex a little bit later. I wondered.
It's a long story about my ex, but yeah, at the time, he was just as astonished as I was when it played out on TV, because I had told him about it, and it wasn't that long ago before it happened. But with him, we shared a daughter. So throughout the years, I would have subsequent dreams about him, even though we weren't together, that were also warnings. So the interesting thing about that is that I would continue to see danger with him and people that he was associated with or things that he was doing. And so I would call him because I shared custody with my daughter. And so I would say to him, I'm seeing this or that, you know, I'm worried about you. And I would clearly articulate warnings to him, and he just denied it the whole time. So that was kind of maddening for me as a mom, because obviously I was sending my daughter to his house every other weekend, and I was also right. picking up on danger. So my job as the mom was to ensure that she, you know, her safety and her health and welfare were, you know, good. And with those dreams coming through, I had paid attention to them before and things had happened. So that was a bit of a difficulty between us. And then eventually, you know, I had more dreams, and then stuff did end up happening that was very bad. But I didn't ever write about that. I never shared those stories just because it was so personal and it was between us. And I didn't also want to hurt my daughter either.
Of course. I was going to say, though, obviously he knew you knew, but was going to continue to lie. So that
he just called me crazy.
Interesting...
That was the hard part. He just called me crazy to everybody, and even to my daughter. He said, "Your mom is crazy, and you can't believe her." And so he was just very difficult. But I still continued to warn him about it when I received warnings, because
I didn't want
anything bad to happen to him, because he was my daughter's dad, you know.
But in his heart of hearts, he had to have known. I mean, you demonstrated it the first time, crazy maybe, but it turned out you weren't, and it was on TV in front of him, so he must have been aware. If you could do that once, he knew what he
was
doing.
Well, I think
that's
the hard part for
sensitive. You might not have known exactly, but...
Yeah, well, that's the hard part for sensitives, is when they pick up stuff like that and they go to share it, you know, it's not immediately always validated, especially if it is, you know, an intuitive hit. It happens sometimes or plays out later, and time is always an interesting thing when you start to document intuitions and you start to watch and pay attention to how you process information sensorially. And so... you know, that's what I became fascinated with. How could I know without knowing? And so that led to me first starting with intuition as kind of like my starting block with the gifts of sensitivity.
And so since it came to you in a dream the first time, did you equate that with, I don't know, some kind of a higher power sending you a message, or just your own subconscious somehow knowing a truth that you didn't know in your conscious mind, the message coming through a dream?
Yeah, it was fascinating to me. I was just so interested in understanding how that process worked. And I went from pillar to post. I went from, okay, this is warnings. Somehow, I mean, I just did it generally first. Like, well, somehow we get warnings. I mean, I put it in that basket first. And then, you know, when it happened repeatedly, and then even on a bigger magnitude in the daytime with the fire prevention, then I knew that there was something very real about it. It wasn't just a one-off. It wasn't just a rare anomalous experience that happened. It was connected to me somehow, because I was the author of the story. And so I knew that somehow through my own, you know, experience, these things were increased, and somehow I was able to intervene in what seemed like safety or survival situations. I mean, that's my first inclination, was to keep me safe. So I first started with mother's intuition. I thought it was a mother's intuitive sense that I had always heard about but never experienced. And this must be what it is. It was, you know, women's intuition.
Okay.
And so that's
kind of where
I started, because that's the only thing that I knew about was women's intuition, or the only thing I had heard about. Now, I didn't go into psychic phenomenon until later, until after the fire. And then I really started to dive deep into, well, what is psychic phenomenon? How did it happen? What are the theories? And immediately when the fire happened, my first thought when we got back to the apartment was, this has to be supernatural. I mean, this had to be divine intervention. I mean, that's mm-hmm. how I put it at the time in my mind, because I couldn't make sense of it any other way. And it couldn't be me, right? It had to be somebody from higher above. But I was very atheistic at the time. And so even mm-hmm. going to that place in my mind that it was a supernatural gift or someone warning me from the other side, maybe perhaps, was a big leap for me, because I really didn't believe in the other side. But through various experiences right. of, you know, having more and more and more pronounced experiences, including from hearing from people on the other side, I had to look at all angles. So I was at first believing that it was one thing, and then I thought it was another thing. And the only way that I can describe it now is that I've looked at the culmination of all these things, and I still stay pretty open-minded about what it is. Now, the science definitely explains a lot of it that we didn't have before 20 years ago. So that, for me, is the most exciting piece, and that's why I wrote the book, is that you can really document a lot of this through neuroanatomy and scientific studies and traumatic experiences that help shape perception in different ways. So that's what I think is so great about the book, is that it really gives people like a compendium of knowledge that I didn't have 20 years ago when I went to search for it. I wrote the book that I couldn't find at the time when I was in my 20s.
Yeah, there you go. Well, and that's interesting how it manifests like that, different sensitivities. And you talk about, I read in the introduction about what kind of a sensitive you are, right? Didn't I?
I do. Yeah, I talk about it, but I don't go into my personal story too much in this book, but I do believe that I'm an intuitive, obviously a visionary, because I have the visions, and so that's the precognitive piece, but I also have extreme deep empathy. And I think it's a combination of all those gifts that allowed me to perceive those threats in my environment.
The different levels that people do this on, I was very interested. I'm very interested, and I want to talk, without giving your book away, but a little bit about the science, because the first thing that, and I didn't have time to go look at science, but I wasn't aware there was any. I'm sure there's probably a lot of people listening tonight that isn't aware, that aren't aware that there is any science on this. We've talked before, and I experienced, I was thinking back about your husband, but I had a near-death experience when I had my ruptured brain aneurysm and died. Excuse me, there must be a fire in my neighborhood. Did you intuit that?
I heard it. I didn't intuit it, but I heard the sirens. Those sirens are always so loud and blaring and scary.
No kidding. And we're sitting here talking about a fire, and I'm hearing that. I'm like, wait a minute. Okay, it's not our house.
We're
going to
shift and start talking about the good stuff now, though, the exciting, positive things, so... The mood will shift.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, anyway, when I had this near-death experience and told my husband at that time, who I was putting through medical school, so there's the true proof of the pudding when you've got a person who's groomed only in science and who does not have that open mind,
right.
You know, somebody who's told what they're supposed to think and not really in tune with feeling or open-mindedness at all. You know, he insisted to me that it was, you know, the medication that I had been on when they put me under and gave me all the reasons why it wasn't what it was. But it was weird because you would know that when these things happen, I was as positive of the reality of it as I am the sun coming up in the morning. It just became mm-hmm. a fact. I didn't even question it. Was there more I wanted to know? Did I want to know the implications of a couple of things? That kind of stuff, sure. But the reality of what happened, any doubt about where that came from? None whatsoever. And then I had some of my listeners know, who are friends of mine on Facebook, another experience different than that with an owl that I named Hootie, a small owl.
How appropriate.
And I know, that's what I thought. And Hootie and I have an intuitive relationship, but the way that it started, and I didn't know anything about, you know, or judge, I guess. I just didn't know anything about, like, totem animals. I had heard people say that if a cardinal comes by, it's bringing a message from someone on the other side. But I had had a dog, and it was the last my dog before I got married and we started having our dogs, okay? Mario was a year old when I met my husband. So we had the first year just he and I together. So he lives to be 15, and,
wow,
you know, he's older and slower. Yeah. But he'd come out, and I'd carry him to the down the couple stairs of the deck and put him in the yard, and he would walk so slow over to this big tree we have in our yard and lay under the right side of the tree in the shade and just, you know, be being, you know, feeling the air and smelling the grass, and that's just kind of where his place was. And so when he died, you know, you find yourself always looking in that spot, you know, because that's where he's supposed to be, right? So every time you walk in the backyard, you glance over there, and that's where he's supposed to be, but he's not. And so my grandmother also had passed away shortly after that. And we had a very close relationship from the time that I was a kid. And so it was just a very short amount of time, and I felt my bangs, something kind of blow by my head. And I looked up on the right side of the tree, but up just a little higher, 15 feet maybe or so, and there was a natural hollow there, and this wee owl was in the hollow, had flown past my bangs to get my attention, and I looked up, and he's looking at me, this little owl. And we went on to have a relationship. It was in an October that he arrived, and he left in March. And so we had all those months together, and I take pictures, I do photography. So I was out there, I have 1,000,010 pictures of Hootie doing everything, everything a little owl and a hollow can do, you know, baths and eating and all of that stuff. But we were actually transmitting, in a way, communicating during this time. Like, I would rock back and forth on my feet looking at him, and he would start rocking back and forth on his feet. It was obvious that he was aware, you know, very aware of a lot of things that I was doing. And anyway, he wound up leaving that March, and I was real sad that he left because I had grown really fond of him. And I went about life, and the next October, well, anyway, the first time I took it, that the message I got from Hootie the first time is that owls can transmit messages from the other side. They can go in and out of the veil, and that he was letting me know that my Nana and my Mario were fine, and that I was fine, and that all was
that's
as
beautiful.
It should be. That's what
yeah,
I thought.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I thought it was.
And in the teachings that I was given by my teachers, you know, they talked about animals that, you know, medicine that the animals give, and
mm-hmm.
how animals, even though they don't talk, give messages and their spirit medicine in different ways. And so it's beautiful because sometimes, you know, when we are shut off in other ways, you can receive medicine from animals and animal communication. And so many people, it sounds like you might be an empath, especially empaths are able to receive communication from animals. It's one of their gifts and one of their abilities.
Well, one of the things I want to do is get your book because I know some things like you knew some things and haven't done the homework. That's why I'm just throwing a couple things out there to you because, you know,
sure.
A lot of people with their, like I have three dogs. Mario was my fourth. I have my other three dogs and a bird, and I've always been an animal person. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people like me that their dogs are their kids, you know, for the most part. And we have a special relationship, and they give the basic things that we all know. Well, most of us should know, you know, the unconditional love, the warm fuzzy, the companionship, the loyalty, all of those basic fundamental adjectives. But then, you know, there are those who say that they can't communicate. And those of us that are pet moms know that they absolutely can, you know, communicate. But with this owl, there was a reason that it had to be something else. You know, it had to be,
mm-hmm.
had to be what it was. But what happened was, the next October, I was out there in the yard again in October, and I was sitting under the tree because I started kind of hanging out, you know, where Mario used to hang out, and sitting at the base of the tree where Hootie was above. And when I got up the second, you know, the next October, Hootie was back in the hollow.
Mm.
And
wow. That
and then
it
happened a
it?
Third year, last
mm-hmm.
year. It happened again. He came back in October and left in March. And last year, I can't explain the second year to you, but the third year, you know, the pandemic had started. And, you know, I've got underlying conditions. My parents are older. They had underlying conditions. The news was so conflicting. There was so much chaos going on in the world. I said, you know, the next book I'm going to write is the four P's that brought me to my knees.
Mm-hmm.
Protests, politics, parents, protests, pandemic. So pandemic,
yeah.
Politics, protests, parents. Such a chaotic last year. And what Hootie did when he came back last year was give me back my center, because everything just seemed to start fracturing to me, the chaos. You know, I was, I don't know
it
if
did.
You're old enough to remember back in the day when we didn't have a 24-hour news cycle and TV ended at whatever time it ended and you had
We had a UHF. We had a UHF and a rabbit ear antenna off of our house, our little ranch house in Pennsylvania, and a black and white. We had a black and white in my parents' little bedroom.
Yep.
And so, yeah, and we mm-hmm. used to have the emergency broadcasting system that came on. And
yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember those days very, very well. That's my childhood.
Well, that's kind of what my head and innards were feeling like, you know, with the onset of the pandemic and everything else that was going on. You know, I was almost wanting to become agoraphobic. The only place I really felt safe was at home, and I didn't really want to turn on news. Of course, I did, you know, like I did around 9/11, too much news, till you
yep.
know that you've got to shut it off because you're making yourself disturbed.
You well,
know?
You do have to guard your mind. That's one of the things that I tell
yes.
sensitive people. You have to guard your mind, and we can go into sensory overload so easily and so much
yes.
faster because we're receiving so much more information because we have a function. Sensitive people are 1 in 4 or 1 in 5, and we have a sensory function that we are receiving so much information, more than the average sensor. And not only do we perceive more in our environments, we respond emotionally faster. It's called emotional reactivity. So when you're talking about the news cycle and taking that all in, and not only that, the news cycle just is relentless. It's every darn atrocity in your local community, in the world, you know, everything. And so
yes.
we take that all in. And we feel it on such an intense level that I always tell sensitive people to guard your mind. Be careful about what you process. And if you're going to do news cycles and all that emerging onslaught of information that feels like a catastrophic hit to your heart and your soul and that your emotions
yes.
get really, really revved up, that you need to also
yes.
balance that content with therapeutic imagery, peaceful imagery, loving kindness. And so I think Hootie, your companion there, was a balancing force for you during these
yes.
times so that you could connect with nature. And that's the beautiful thing about the pandemic is some people did turn towards nature like they never have before
yes.
for peace, for solitude, for
mm-hmm.
healing, for connection, deep connection. And that includes with the animals. You know, I had a teacher. She was a FBI profiler. But she was also an animal communicator. And so she trained me on how to, you know, first of all, accept the gift because I was still on the fence about what it all was. And she really helped me to embrace it, that it was a reality. But she would communicate with her horse. And she was an expert rider. And she also showed me through her communication, she was an intuitive empath, deep empath, how she could communicate with him. And it was obvious. And so when you start to do things like horse equine therapy, especially for people who have had any kind of injury and you work with the horses,
mm-hmm.
they perceive and communicate in a different way. And they
yes.
They show you that. And you can see through their movements and how you communicate with them with an expert animal communicator or facilitator, especially with people who are rehabbing from injuries, that the horse
yeah.
is an amazing guide into recovery when you can put your faith and trust in them because they help in so many ways as an animal therapist.
That's very true. I've had guests on that have talked about that because it's not only, you know, people with brain injury and spinal
mm-hmm.
cord injury that are listening, but it's also, in fact, it's PTSD month, I believe, right now that they're renaming PTS, but either way, it's this month, and for all of those purposes, you know, the equine therapy has just really had stunning results that survivors wouldn't necessarily be able to have right away with people. You know, they get connected
and
shown what they need to do with the horse. Exactly.
Yeah.
They need to like
mm-hmm.
decompress, have an in-between buffer, a gentle buffer. And that's what the horse seems to be in my observation of having had both the people that provide the therapy and people who have partaken in the therapy. It seems that's kind of where it's at. Those people weren't ready to be talking about what was going on in their head and heart with someone else, maybe couldn't articulate it yet, didn't want to or weren't able to at that time. And the horse led them to a place of feeling safe to be able
yes,
to discuss
so many
it.
Times that's what happens. Yes. So many
mm-hmm.
times, and you can see it happen when you're there And when you're in the company, safe company, between an equine therapist, the horse, and the person who's working with them. Because the therapist helps to translate the communication between the animal's behavior with the individual who's working with them. And so trust can develop so fast. I mean, that's the thing that's different about words and psychotherapy versus animal-assisted therapy, because the animal has all those sensory awarenesses and situational awareness so much because they rely on their senses, because they don't communicate with their words. They communicate through body,
right, language.
And so I've seen it where I've seen individuals who are coming back from something traumatic on every level, and the horse can help them almost immediately with a good therapist. And it's amazing to watch it unfold. And it seems miraculous, but once you've seen it, you start to understand that there's something else there, subtle, the subtle energetic connection between the animal. And so that's why I was mentioning animals have wisdom, and animals appear mm-hmm. when we need that medicine, and they bring it through, you know, whether it's symbolically in a dream or whether it's in reality, in material reality, where you see them like you did with Hootie in the Hollow, and they help us in moments where we need
yes.
that medicine and we need that connection to nature, because they're part of nature. And so are we. We forget that.
Well, and I know, and it's funny that I got the message that way, because I thought I was being, you know, some people will tend to watch one channel or the other because they lean one way or the other. And mm-hmm. I wanted to be fair, knowing that there's no such thing as reporting anymore, where somebody's just going to give facts and assume you have a brain and let you decide. That left a long
news
time ago.
News has definitely
you
changed.
Know.
Yeah, it's not what it used to be.
It
that's
has.
For sure.
No. So I would watch both channels knowing they were both biased and try mm-hmm. to decide where my middle was. But see, that was feeding fair enough, you know, and being versed in what was going on from both points of view. However, there was a point where what you were talking about was exactly true, and that's that just gave me even more, because it's playing two different songs at the same time. You know, they both have different opinions. And so you watch too much of that stuff, and like I said, it just brings you to test pattern brain and overstimulation. And so, yeah, then it's like October and Hootie comes back, and I never went back to the TV, and I got it. I got it right away.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I'm powerless over what is going on that I'm consuming myself with being knowledgeable about. I know enough, you
right.
know, I need to
yes.
connect with life force, not something that is going to drain me worse. You know, I need to connect
emotionally.
With life force.
Yeah,
and that's
news
gonna
is
be
such
outside.
An emotional drain. It's emotionally exhausting. I mean, it
mm-hmm.
is, especially for sensitives, when we already have that much faster, like lightning reactivity, emotional reactivity. I mean, that's what makes us sensitive. It's one part of it. I mean, the other part is receiving too much. It's not helpful. But if you can figure out where your threshold is, right, what is receiving
yes.
just the right amount, then it becomes a beautiful balancing act, and you feel connected and deeply restored in ways when you're using that positive, peaceful imagery, because it's the same mechanism where we feel that emotional reactivity so much faster than others to what we're perceiving. When you start to change the images and the picture, and maybe that includes nature, or maybe it includes connecting with, you know, other people that are supportive and love and kind, then we are living deeply and connecting deeply without that that fear or that unrest or
mm-hmm.
that emotional exhaustion that just racks us. It lays us out. Then
yes.
you use the same mechanisms for the positivity, and life kind of opens up and becomes beautiful, and then you expect beauty rather than the painful aspect.
Yes, and I'm so grateful that I'm so grateful that Hootie imparted these messages, you know, at the time that that I needed it. So I will be anxious to see if he comes back a fourth year in October. But anyway, those are just a couple of the completely different scenarios, but where something happened, well, that doesn't happen every day, you know, and
right.
I too have had a couple of dreams. And so when I was introduced to you, and I wasn't really introduced to her, I was introduced about Courtney, not to Courtney.
Mm-hmm.
I was very interested as I was reading, because you frequent listeners know that I talk a lot about the traditional medical model, and that the science there has been somewhat lacking in helping survivors. They're great at saving our life, which I don't downplay at all. You know, you can't beat a good neurosurgeon if you need one, you know. It's
emergency
a very handy
medicine,
thing to have.
We have it in spades. Yep, we have emergency medicine.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep. If you need that, you need it. But you know what nobody seems to want to address, except to throw a pill at it, is what you get to keep, the giveaway, takeaway. Because, you know, and a lot of times in any game-changing event, whether it's a brain injury or some other serious health problem or a divorce or whatever the game-changing deal is, we think that we can go back a lot of times to where we were before. I just
mm-hmm.
want to get better so I can, you know, go back to where I was before. And what
mm-hmm.
happens around here is that you're never really, even if you look it, walk, talk, sound it, look it, you're never going to go back to exactly where you were before because of what happened. You know, and some of the things that brain injury survivors take away is, you know, neuro fatigue, short-term memory loss. Because of my short-term memory loss, I don't remember the rest of my
Well, and sometimes it's
disorders,
communication delays.
You know?
Sometimes
yes.
it's seeing things
disorders.
And sometimes it's not. Or sometimes it's feeling that
mm-hmm.
expansiveness, and other times it's feeling that raw vulnerability. I mean, it really depends on what has changed through that process. But I love what you said in the opening, and when I read your website about embracing the new me, that
mm-hmm.
is beautiful. And I felt it was so articulate and poignant about embracing what happens and what unfolds, because other strengths do come out if there's been an injury or if there's been an event. Other things are strengthened. And so my whole point with writing the book about the sensitivity is that a lot of times there are injuries and there are strengths
mm-hmm.
when there has been an event that seem to come about as the brain or other parts of the body are strengthened to help compensate for what happened. And so that's the beautiful piece about the human mind and body when they're connected, is who is the new me that's emerging through that process, and how can I embrace that person without looking back to the past and feeling all that pain about what was lost. And so one of my favorite people
yeah.
is Dr. Oliver Sacks. Do you know who he is?
Yes, music therapy, huh?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and he also talked about having these events in life that change your reality, change your world, change who you are, right? Personality changes or
yeah.
other things that happen. And he really
yeah.
goes into helping, he's passed away now, but he really does go into
yeah.
what makes us human are these things
mm-hmm.
that happen, and how we can connect and communicate deeply and support one another. So I loved your message through your website that I read that talked about this
Thank
process
you.
And the recovery process. And I love your position as an advocate and as someone who's gone through these things yourself, so you can help others. It's really beautiful. And it is what we need more of in our environments, communities that can help one another.
Well, thank you. It seems like the hardest ones sometimes to help are the ones closest to us sometimes. You know, I've got family going through a transition right now. And, you know, those words that I wrote, it wasn't that a lot of us learn that the hard way, you know, by swimming upstream for too long, nearly drowning, and then we're at a jumping off place where we need to make a decision. You know, and that first day of mine, awareness, I'm never going to go back to exactly where I was before. Now what? You know, I've got a big black hole of mystery in front of me, and I can glance back but not stare, because you can't unring the bell. That horse is already out of the barn, and so you're in this tweener stage. And I just think that, you know, our lives, somebody a million years ago wrote a book called Passages, and I think it's true. You know, we naturally go through different passages in our life for a reason or necessity, and maybe we go kicking and screaming and it's not something that we expected. But what I found is, you know, that you were reading about, and then I'll share something about a lot of the others that call, and I'm glad you, Sax, is that it's normal to grieve the loss, but, you know, there, and I'm not saying people put a time limit on it, but you really don't want to spend the rest of your life in grief, immobile. You know, you want to come back to life, and that's one of the things I enjoyed about the connection with nature, is that's where the living is, out in nature. You know, is you get connected with the living again, instead of that flat screen, you know, or on computer. I limit my time on there too. People can't believe that, you know, they send me messages on Facebook and they send me emails, and I actually don't have notifiers come to my phone. It's enough for me to get texts, and if somebody leaves a phone message for me, that's enough, you know. And I knew about social media the first day I got on it. I knew what it was designed to do, keep you there. And so,
well, I have a story I want to share too along those lines, but go ahead. Don't let me forget about this friend I want to share a little bit about the internet and social media, but you're on to something.
Oh,
so
good.
I don't want to interrupt you.
No, I got it. And I'm not, don't forget that point, 'cause I'm almost done with it. I was just going to say, I knew that they wanted you to stay, that it had an addictive property to it, and that they had likely spent billions of dollars to make it so. And so I've been down that road on another venue before. And so when I felt that pull, I was like, no, I'll be controlling the social media. It won't be controlling me. And
well,
I don't want to hear any more pings. I don't want to hear any more pings on my phone, you know, so I will choose to look at my email once a day for sure, usually twice a day, maybe when I get up in the morning, and if I have time after dinner, you know, then I'll check the email. Facebook, same thing, you know, maybe I'll log on and look at that a couple of times a day, check out, you know, what some friends are doing, be partially present. But I'm not present all the time there. I don't want to live that way. You know, I could tell in the first week or two that it would be very easy to forget that life was out here, that it isn't in there. You know, you have what people want you to see, and I'm guilty of that. You know, one of the compliments that I get about my Facebook page is it's mostly all photographs that I've taken. So it's our life in photographs. And
beautiful.
And the photographs are very uplifting, you know, and so people will come and are kind enough to say nice things. and whatever they've got going on in their life, they see the beauty that I've found through the lens. We leave the city and go on country drives is what we do. That's how we spend our quality time, is getting out of the chaos and into the country where I take pictures of things. But, you know, we're smiling because that in that moment, you know, in those moments I'm capturing is the photograph I'm posting. We're happy, and those are the things that I'm seeing. Do I go on there and talk about other things, the days that I'm not happy and when I'm in my pity pot or really torn and upset about something? No. And so, you know, the whole game behind social media is, and I'm not playing a game, I'm putting up my photographs and choosing to do it that way, but you see what people allow you to see or what people want you to see, and sometimes that's genuine and sometimes it's not. It's certainly not complete because you've got poor people out there who are depressed or they've got havoc going on in their life, and they look at that and they think that those moments are what, in this example, what my life is like all the time,
mm-hmm.
which isn't true. You know, it isn't true. I'm the first one to say that. That isn't true. I just don't use Facebook as my therapist. That's all. And I'm not judging anybody who does, you know, but I just knew that there was something, my intuition told me that there was something inherently evil behind what seemed very innocent when people started mm-hmm. with Facebook to get on to look at pictures of their grandkids or whatever, you know. I think, you know, my generation missed Space Case or, you know, whatever it was,
my
the first,
space.
the first
mm-hmm.
generation.
Yeah, MySpace was the
totally
first iteration of, yeah, uh-huh.
I
well,
missed
I
that
think
completely.
That's so and, often that's true. I think what you're saying is so right on point, because so often the intuition immediately tells us a whole story, right? We get the picture. Mm-hmm. We get an insight. And sometimes it's way ahead of the curve. And it can be off the charts for some people. And the problem is that we get, you know, hooked into the societal stuff, what everybody's doing. And we kind of get carried away with it and we forget that original instinct. And then we have to draw back and go, oh, you know, this is what I was feeling, or this is what I was seeing. This isn't helpful, or this isn't healthy. And so often intuition does tell us what's not good for us, but we don't not necessarily want to listen to it. I have an example. I met a woman in graduate school. She was brilliant. And she asked me at, like, the morning buffet table, well, what are you doing? And I said, I'm researching this concept called sensitivity. And, you know, I have a number of years in my belt, and I really want to fine-tune it, and I want to write my own research, and yada, yada, yada. And she got it right away. She's like, this is amazing. And then she talked about this school up in Canada for the highly gifted. I mean, she was just incredible. Well, what I didn't know was that she had had a traumatic brain injury years before. And so we became good friends, and she was started to struggle in school, and I saw it. And I also could tell that she didn't have the ability to turn off. Where other people in social situations would, you know, they would share their part, they would share their piece of a story, she just kind of ran on everybody. And so I would try to give her social cues and say, hey, like, you know, it's a shared space, we need to contribute, and everybody needs to be able to have their space. She didn't really get that right away, and I didn't know what was going on, but I knew something was going on with her. And I didn't know if it was social anxiety or what, but we became good friends. And over time, she had told me what had happened, and she had suffered a traumatic brain injury. Of course, I knew about traumatic brain injuries because I worked at Harborview, the Pacific Northwest's primary trauma center in the Northwest. And so I was familiar with it. And so I started to see that she was going to have deadlines, time management, all the stuff that she was doing in her degree, which was a you know, a graduate level program. And I tried to suggest, hey, I think you should get an ADA accommodation, you know, to be able to turn assignments in on your timetable that your teachers and your professors will understand that you need a little bit more. And the thing that's so difficult sometimes about the past when you were one way, and then after the injury happens, what the reality is, when you negate it, how painful that is. And so you were talking about your community and having it sometimes be harder when you're in your own community and you're, you know, searching for connection and support and all these things as you're becoming and transforming through this process. One of the things that helped me help my friend was to be very honest and pragmatic, because I didn't want her to fail and I didn't want her to lose all the student loan money that she was putting into the program, not recognizing that she really was struggling. And so over time, she told me her story and she opened up to me, and it was beautiful because I was able to help her in very real pragmatic ways as a friend to go back on disability, to make the case for it, to get another neurological exam because she hadn't had one. And get this, when she went to the hospital after she had her TBI, they discharged her right away. And she didn't have follow-up for a while afterwards. And so I kind of helped her go back into her case and make the case to be reevaluated. And she did that. She did listen to me. She was offended at first that I brought it up. But when I broke it down to her with kindness and compassion and love and care, really, as a friend, she went back and she did make the case for it, and it helped her. But with that being said, she was not happy about it, and she still struggled. And one of the things that I wanted to mention about the social media and everything, she just got totally hooked into all of it, conspiracy theories and, you know, really far out stuff that totally changed her personality. And so it's not healthy. It's really not. And she was so sensitive that she was affected by all of it. And so at one point, I think I mentioned, you just need to turn that stuff off, because she started to believe in really far out stuff, and her personality started changing even more because of the social media, because of the conspiracy theories, because it was on all the time. And so I saw that happening, and I agree with you. It was not helpful, and it is not helpful to stay hooked into those kind of things, because then it kind of becomes part of your belief system, even if it wasn't before.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I could tell. And there's this level of bullying going on between people. That's another thing, is that when people are invisible, quote unquote invisible, right? They do things that they might not otherwise do face to face, say things, you know, they might not otherwise say face to face, and are less inhibited. And that's not always a good thing. You know, there's an old saying, you never have to apologize for something you didn't say. you know.
Well, and a lot of my discussions with her became grounding. I mean, I know that she respected me because I helped kind of break down the Social Security disability process and that she should go back. And I gave her the steps, the concrete steps of what to do within the system to get approved for it. And she did that, and it worked for her, and she was successful. And I know that she respected that. And in the conversations that we would have about all this stuff that was going on, I mean, without going into excruciating detail about it was just the phantomagoric world changing stuff that she was, you know, just going out so far. And I couldn't go there. I mean, I can in a fantasy go there, but not when you're trying to make it a reality. That's too much for me. So my conversations with her as a friend became very much about questioning her thought process and questioning reality and grounding her in reality in a way that I tried to help keep her tethered to the earth versus going out really into these wild goose chases that were not going to help her have a high quality of life. And so I think as friends and people who are supportive, when we see this stuff happening with social media or see it kind of running away, you know, like a train, that it's good to keep others grounded as much as you can without shutting them down, but also saying, I don't think this is helpful for you, which is a kind message of love.
Yes, I do too. Well, I do too, because you can put it in the same category as the news. And, you know, one of the things, you know, I talk about here is, and you know, you talked about it earlier, and that's finding our boundaries, you know, that balance in our boundaries. And, you know, the deck is against you on things where they do spend, and that's easy enough for her to check out or anybody to check out there who's become addicted, you know, to social media, is that they spent... You know, I remember reading once or seeing a documentary at some point in my life a long time ago about casinos, and I wondered why I couldn't stand, I guess I'd rather shop than take a chance at losing money, but I can't handle the noise, that sensory overload in casinos, so I can't go in there. I've been there a couple times, and I have to, like, leave 15 minutes later. I can't stand that noise. It brings me the same kind of chaos. And I remember seeing this documentary at one point that they design, like, say, slot machines to have a certain kind of metal that makes the coins dropping in them louder. And for the people that are going to have a proclivity to be addicted toward that, they're going to start salivating when they hear those coins dropping in at that frequency, at that loud frequency. And, you know, that's how they do that. And there's, I'm sure, many other things.
I mean, that's classic Pavlovian conditioning. The interesting thing about what you're saying is that, I mean, they did studies on intermittent reinforcement way back in the 70s, where if you were sitting somewhere and, you know, it was like a feeding thing, or even if it's a casino where you're sitting at the machine, if it's a like a keno machine or whatever, that it was more attractive and more addictive, and the attraction to stay was even heightened if you only got paid every other fifth time. And so intermittent reinforcement was shown through classical conditioning and Pavlovian conditioning early on. But what's interesting about what you're saying is that they're using the sound and the decibel volume for people that are attuned to that, you know, or sound sensitive is what we would call it, auditory sensitivity, that they, that just at that right decibel level, there's something about that. So it's almost like the coins are being used for the inner written reinforcement rather than even being paid, which is even more treacherous because you're only hearing the sound versus actually getting the real coins.
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely true. And they did the same thing with Facebook. They've had a number of people, former disgruntled employees and others, who have spilled the beans about the amount of money they spent going in to make it addictive, to make Facebook addictive. And I imagine the others too, you know, Twitter and all the rest. But Facebook, definitely did it. And that can be found, unless Google's covering their butt now, that science was out there and it was no secret, you know, that Facebook had spent a fortune before they put up their platform on how to keep people there. Part of it, you know, too, is like the likes and things like that. I don't know enough about it to be able to tell you enough about it, except that, you know, my intuit immediately on getting in and just the feel of how it worked, I knew it already, you know.
Well, it sounds like you're an intuitive empath to me. I mean, take the test. I have the sensitivity test online. That's part of the book. I mean, you'll see that when you get through the intro chapter, as I say to all the readers, like, if you're curious at the outset what you are, do the test, and then you can jump to that chapter. But it sounds like from everything you're saying to me that you are an intuitive empath, and that's when two gifts overlap. They kind of converge, and that's why I call it the multi-sensory intelligence, because it's not just one ability. You have two overlapping abilities that kind of work in concert to give you feedback or information, and then you can use that or, you know, or apply it. And it sounds like you are, you know, in the casino gambling example, you knew something about it was not helpful for you or not right. And you were, it was adversive. It wasn't a positive feeling. Whereas most people, you know, who are going to get into that conditioning, like we were talking about, are going to hear it and go, ooh, this is interesting, and then be attracted, and they get hooked in, and then, you know, lose their savings. Or God forbid, if they don't have savings, they're just blowing their paycheck. You know, I used to see that when I worked as a waitress and as a bartender in Missoula when I was putting myself through college. I mean, it was just painful watching people blow their whole paycheck that they worked all week for. Really painful to see that. So it sounds like you have intuitive and empathic abilities. Does that make sense to you? Do you feel that that's accurate?
I do, and in fact, there's someone in the chat room that just told me, gosh, I'll have to scroll up. He took your test, and I said to the guy, to the man in the chat room, I said, oh, my God, I wanted to do that, you know, back when I first read your things, and I booked out.
There's
so
always
far
time. You can always do it. It's not going anywhere.
Can't wait to do it because and again, I'm going to put in the web because there's a few people in the chat room. It's in my program.
Well, to
notes,
go to the test, I want to share the actual website to go to the test because that's different than the one you shared in the intro. So if you want to take the test, which is connected to the book, you just need to go to Inspired Potentials and go to Google and just type in those two words, Inspired Potentials, and it will take you right to my website. And the test is right at the top as you land on the Inspired Potentials website page. So that's easy. And I say Inspired Potentials because nobody can spell my name. They can't sound it out, and they can't say it. So Inspired Potentials is easy. It'll take you right there. And then I send you your answers, and I send you a nice note. I score all the tests individually, and then I send you a nice reply, and then I offer for you, if you have any questions or any lingering thoughts, to connect with me, you know, and like a little intuitive one-on-one. And if folks have any questions, then I try to answer everything after they take the test.
So, hang on, I'm writing two places.
It's okay.
Inspired Potentials. So you told people they could Google it, but does that wind up being inspiredpotentials.com, or you just Google?
Yeah.
The
yep,
two words.
That's my website, inspiredpotentials.com.
Okay, good.
Yep, that's it.
Got it.
And then you can.
I just wanted to put it in the chat room for people. I was holding my hand.
Yeah, good idea. Good idea. That helps them to know where to
go.
Yeah.
Yep, that's what I was thinking. I put the words and then I put .com, and when you said to Google it, I got that, but I was about ready to hit send because I had put it as a website, and I was holding my finger hovering over over the
yeah,
button.
Well, the other one, the other one you shared is the Wellness Universe, and I am on the Wellness Universe too, but the test isn't on the Wellness Universe. It's only on Inspired Potentials. That's my personal website.
Okay, great. Folks, one of the things I'm going to do for those of you that are listening, you guys in the chat room just got the that website, inspiredpotentials.com. For those of you who are listening, you heard the first website I gave you, the wellness website, and when we're finished with the show, I will edit it and website in as well. And so you'll be able to find inspiredpotential.com in the program notes also if you're interested.
Did the guy in the chat room have a question? Oops, sorry. Did the guy in the chat room have a question?
I'm not sure.
Just curious.
Let's see. M4P. Do you have a question? In fact, I was kind of wondering, he's actually called Man for Peace. He probably won't care that I say that, but I was addressing him as that, and then I started calling him M4P. And so I've got M4P. Do you have a question? And because I had to scroll up, I would have to scroll up so far. If you have a question, anyone, you can call in to 424-243-9540. Again, 424-243-9540. You can press 1 if you have a question. And if you don't have a question or don't want to call M4P, tell me again what you said you were, because he did take the test. In fact, he was the one that made me upside my head go, oh, God, in all that basket of things that my life has been fragmented that I meant to do and didn't. He did, you know, and so he's the one that brought it back to my mind. Thank you. I rang the alarm bells. I'm not sure what that means, but I will put 424-243-9540 in the chat room if anybody has a question. Took the test. It's fine. I've always known I'm a wide open channel. Does that make sense to you?
It does. Yeah. Well, the senses are how we first develop, right, in utero. And when we come out, when we're born, the senses are what's developing. But, you know, they've been developing the whole time through in utero development. But then when you come out, the senses are really how we explore the world first as babies. So wide open is a great way to explain what that means, because we are literally wide open. We don't have any way to shut down our senses when we're developing, when we're children. Now, when we're babies, when we're children, then we can shut it out. That's why you see kids with their ears, you know, shut or their eyes closed, is because there's too much. It's overstimulating. And when we describe, you know, sensations and sensory awareness, a lot of people describe it as being wide open, you know, because you're not able to really filter out sensory information. And so we're considered wide open because we're receiving all that information, all that sensory through sound, taste, tactile, touch, feeling, hearing, and sensitives hear, feel, see, touch, and experience more in that sensory awareness. That's what kind of, you know, that's what sensitivity is. It's being wide open with our senses.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He talked about being a channel. We've got a couple people here, a regular listener whose mom recently passed away, and M4P said that his grandmother, I believe, had been really afraid to transition, and that he had helped her do that. He had helped her feel more comfortable from this end, helping her to make the transition to the other side. And Ron, a regular listener here, just went through that. My condolences to both of you. And I know about Ron's contribution and M4P. Now I know about yours, and such a blessing, because my experience in having made the journey is, you know, when I got clocked with the rupture, I had been perfectly fine, having a normal day like we're all having a normal day, and that's why you see in a flash, I don't know why I named my show what I did, because I had a show for a short time before called In a Flash, and then my book is In a Flash. Everything's in a flash because that's how quickly things can change.
Yeah, I went
right?
to your book. So, I went to your page book, and I want to read your book because I saw it in a flash, and I think it's a very poignant, totally appropriate title. That's how it happens, is in a flash.
It is. Well, and then you see, if you're on there, that I wrote one on Hootie's Hollow because I had to write
the story. I didn't see the Hootie story, but I did go to your book page and I looked at your experience and I saw that you had had an NDE. And right now, it's so interesting that we're talking because right now I'm writing a competitive paper for the Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies because they did a big open competition for people, scientists, researchers, anybody really who has done research on the afterlife. And their research question is, show the best possible evidence that consciousness survives physical bodily death. And so I got in. I was surprised that I got in, but I did. And so I'm writing my 25,000 word essay to compete against people all around the world to show that we do have evidence. And I believe that evidence is in highly sensitive people. And I also believe that evidence is in the after effects after an NDE, because people who come back from clinical death usually have heightened or augmented sensory awareness, and they're able to perceive. You had after effects, most likely, from your NDE. Was that ever explained to you, or did anybody discuss?
No. Mm-mm. No, the end of that story.
I think that's such a shame, because it would be helpful to people who are coming back to go through that intense transition back to reality from where they've been.
Well, M4P did call in, so I'll be right with you, and we'll take your question.
Okay.
But the part about my NDE is that husband of mine never believed it and invalidated it, and I divorced him because I could see that I was looking at what he was studying, and I told you I was putting him through med school, and I'm seeing us being referred to as exposure units and the way that science was being presented. And if he couldn't believe his wife, I just didn't want to do that. It changed me. That experience changed me. And so whatever made me want to, that's a long story, like your husband. We'll leave
that
for
now. I know. When you were asking me about my husband, my ex-husband, and how he responded to it, I felt there was a personal touch in there. A lot of times we're not believed. Other people don't believe it, and they mock us, or we get humiliated or ridiculed. And that's why I'm trying to change it. That's what I hope to do with my work.
And now... Exactly. And now I freely talk about it, and no apologies.
Good.
Believe it, don't believe it, you know, whatever.
You're helping other people looking, though, for somebody else who has a story like theirs to find validation, and that's the beauty of what you're doing, I think.
Well, and I also know that even though you grieve because you miss someone that you've lost, I know that where they're going is a good thing, especially if you've been around someone who's been suffering and their quality of life isn't going to get better. It's harder to explain, you know, the young, the quick. All I can say is that they're okay too. I don't know why they were taken early. But in other cases where people's quality of life isn't going to get better, I know that they make a spiritual transition that makes them whole and healthy again in the spiritual plane. And it's
a mercy.
Us and our grief, we need to, exactly.
It's a spiritual mercy to transition faster, and nature, you know, gives us that to be able to transition.
Exactly. Here, let me bring on Man for Peace. M4P, you're on the air. How's it going?
Greetings, this is David, and I have to say, as a highly sensitive person, it's very challenging that you're calling me man for pee, but I'm fine with it.
Well, I was wondering if it was empath, empath, like to the fourth power. That's how I saw it in my mind, phonetically.
Yeah, no, it's actually spelled out man with the number four, and then peace is spelled out. And I'm just kidding.
Okay.
I don't mind the abbreviation. I don't mind the nickname. It's fine. I've really enjoyed the show, and I was just kind of roasting some mushrooms and listening, and then got involved in the chat. I actually do have a kind of a comment question. I knew I was different as a child, and I really struggled in school with my family, with my sensitivities, and I was harshly criticized and rebuked and punished, and at 15, my father drove me to a mental institution and tried to have me committed. And I had the benefit of the woman, the head doctor of this mental health facility. She took me into her office privately and she said, listen, what I'm about to say to you is illegal. This cannot ever leave this room. Sorry, I won't mention her name, so it's now leaving her room. But she said to me, you don't need to be here. She said, you obviously have depression. She said, you're a highly sensitive person. You're going to have great challenges in life, but you don't need to be in an institution. You don't need to be medicated. And what you need to do is keep your head down until you're 18 and get away from your father as quickly as you can. And she said, and with that, I need to say goodbye. And I recognized that she was like a supernatural angel in my life. And I did exactly what she said. I kept my head down. I barely got through high school and got away from my father. And so what's happened is my sensitivity, there's been supernatural interference or guidance, and that my sensitivities come and go. So I was able to go and live in New York and work on Broadway, and I could be fine and function there. But then all of a sudden it was over and I couldn't be in New York a day longer. And and so it's kind of come in fits and waves through most of my life. But now as I'm 57 now, and I'm fortunate that I don't have to go out and work in the world, and I have a beautiful estate property and my organic gardens, and I'm living the plush life. But now it's just wide open. And it has been for years.
Good for you.
Here's my question.
Yeah.
So what's happened is that I generally have to close off my energy when I go out in public because I'm too intense and I'm feeling too much. And what happens is other highly intuitive people perceive me as being dishonest or hiding things.
Oh.
So like if I go into a yoga class where there's some serious energy,
really?
They treat me as like dark energy because they can't see me. But if I totally opened up, it wouldn't work either. So I'm struggling to find the balance. So if you have any input on that would be awesome.
Okay. Well, this is very interesting because I don't know if you were listening when I was describing one of my teachers. She was an FBI profiler.
Yeah, I heard the whole show.
She was a deep empath, but also an intuitive. And so, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I would definitely say now looking back, she was a gifted intuitive empath. And one of the things that she told me when we were training together was that she said, you know, you're going to have people who cannot be around you. And I wasn't sure what she was talking about. So I said, well, you know, what do you mean? And she's like, they're going to sense you're intuitive and you're looking right through them. And that's going to make them feel very uncomfortable. And I said, okay. I didn't really believe her at the time, but I do now. Because the justification she used was that the intuitive sense that I had and the visionary ability would show clarity about that kind of, dishonesty or secrets or things that they were trying to hide, and that I would be able to see them and that would make them feel vulnerable. Now, what you're talking about it's so interesting because it's like shoe on the other foot, that it's inverted, where you're in with intuitives and they sense that you're not being honest. And so I'm curious about that. Have people said that to you?
Me too.
Exactly, that they feel like you're being dishonest?
I'm often accused of having dark energy. And I think that that's just the cover phrase for when they don't, I mean, first of all, I mean, I'm not the, I'm a pretty kind, benevolent old soul, but I'm not a 5D love and light and energy guy. And,
sure. Yeah, I'm not either. I relate to that.
Me either.
That's
me
right.
Too.
That's why I'm listening to the show, because as soon as I start hearing that, I'm like, yeah, I heard that 20 years ago, and it's not happening. You know, the rainbow children aren't here. They're all just sitting at home watching the Kardashians. Anyway, it's interesting because they look at me and I can see them that they just don't trust me. I mean, I have enough of my intuition to know that I'm just often not trusted. And I sometimes, I've gone to meditation retreats and I've opened up, and generally that doesn't bring in, if I'm fully open in a safe space, I can talk to like the facilitators, but everyone else is just kind of like keeps away. So
okay, Yeah, I think I know what's going on. I have a couple different theories. Okay, so theory number one, and you'll have to ferret out which one you feel is closely has the ring of authenticity. But number one is projection. So when people are intuitive or empathic, sometimes they get triggered when they're around somebody else and they don't know why, because it's not something that they've experienced or it's not in their conscious awareness as to why it is, but it's a gut level triggering. And so we hear about triggers, right? It's all over.
Yep.
It's all over. It's hit critical mass. We get it. So they might be projecting what they're feeling through that empathic connection to you outward and projecting it onto you. It might not have anything to do with you. So that's theory number one. Or theory number two is that you are definitely raising up or enervating or activating, would be another word, energies in them that they're not used to. And so that's the same kind of spectrum as triggering, but not exactly, because the energy that you have could be very light. It also could be very high vibration, and anytime there's a super high vibration that comes into an empath or an intuitive's awareness, it's always going to set them off, okay, one way or another, good or bad. So some people who are empaths are lifted up by that energy. So I can relate, because when I've done the trainings and the meditation retreats and the energy work, my vibration is very, very high. And it's uncomfortable, okay, for other individuals. And I've seen it happen, and facilitators have guided me through it with a group. And they've said, look, you just need to vibe at this level for a very few minutes and then let it go, because it's uncomfortable. And so maybe that sounds like woo talk and fifth dimension or whatever, but the reality is if your energy is too high, it's not going to feel comfortable to other individuals, and it might not be dark. It might just be discordant because they can't go to that range. How does that sound?
Yes, I agree. Both of your theories, I think, can happen in the same situation. I'm there. I'm with you, and I'm aware of my energy, and I'm also.
You have a right. The thing that's important about that in acknowledging it is that you have a right to vibrate where you're at. What I've been taught is that if we want to have that connection, okay, with other individuals who don't necessarily vibe or resonate or can even hear us, okay, at that level because they shy away or it's discomfort and uncomfortable to them, what we have to do in our work is to try to soften it in a way that makes it easier to connect, if that's what we want. But you have every right to be who you are, vibe where you're at, and not change, okay? That means being as big as you want. That means being who you are in the space, taking up as much space as you naturally do. The problem with it is because we are sensitive, is we do want to connect. We really do. We want to be in a relationship with others. We don't want to be the odd man out. We don't want to have people turn their backs on us. But I do think that it's up to us to soften it for others, not for them necessarily to get it and to come towards us if they don't positively radiate the same way. Does that make sense?
It does, and that's an important distinction, because what I do is I shade it or I close it off, and softening is a much different thing than shading or shielding.
Yeah, well, in closing off, I've got to say, you can close off. I used to try to close off, tamp down, push down, however you want to use the language, but that didn't help me. That actually made more chaos in my life. It was when I opened up and became my true self and let my true awareness came in and sat with that, then things, I did go through a period where everything kind of was destroyed in my life, everything. But then when I came out the other side, with actually the FBI profiler guiding me through that life transition, things became a lot easier, smoother, softer, more gentle. And I think because I was unwilling to open up and she helped me to in a way that was natural and I trusted her through the process, I didn't have to tamp down or hide or push things down anymore. I could just be. And then as I grew into that awareness and grew into who I really was, people came towards me and wanted to be closer rather than the other. Which was more of like a, oh, I don't get her, or she's too intense, or whatever, you know, or even pejorative stuff, you know, you're crazy, you know. So
I think that
transition can allow greater connection is what I'm trying to say.
I think so, too. And all I was going to say in my observation is that he's been here since the beginning of the show, and I didn't. You know, I'm pretty good at, I didn't pick up that vibe from you. Now, granted, we haven't met in person, but I did not pick up that vibe from you at all in the chat room. And when we were talking, I find it enlightening that you expanded on just the kindness and the softness I picked up on, that's maybe picking up on something that's deeper in you than the superficial that others might be seeing and making this judgment about. I think that she's right. You know, with me sometimes I can be out there, and I think sometimes people are intimidated because we know things they're afraid or not ready to hear, or when being out there or whatever can be off-putting to others because that's not something they feel comfortable with. And it's true. You know, I talk about the disability movement, and, you know, it wasn't that long ago, went on up to the 80s, where anybody who was different, and in this case it's different, but I mean anybody with disabilities, anybody who made the status quo people feel uncomfortable, all the way down to maybe someone who just had a seizure disorder or kids with developmental disabilities, things like that, they institutionalized these people out of sight, out of mind. It made status quo uncomfortable. They locked them up and got them out of sight. So I agree with Courtney. I'm very real about who I am, but also as I was learning those boundaries for myself, knowing when I tripped over a boundary and went too far and was causing too much sensory overload or too much of something else or not enough of this, and, you know, finding my own balance, that it was not only between me and myself, but me and other people as well. But I don't know if it makes you feel any better, but apparently Courtney feels the same way talking to you, and I've gotten to spend 2 hours with you just feeling your vibe in the chat, and I didn't pick up on anything like that. So it really surprises me to hear you say that.
And I have something to add too
that's
before he goes.
Their problem.
Yeah, I have something to add too before he goes. So, David, it was David, right?
Yes.
Are you teaching acting now? Like, I really feel like, is that another phase in your life that's about to happen, or have you been incubating or creating ideas about teaching acting or drama or expressive art therapy, anything along those lines?
I taught acting in L.A. for a while years ago. But yeah, it's not something I would go back to at this point.
Okay.
Yeah,
I just came up as we were talking, and I just was curious what your plans were.
Yeah, no, my plans are kind of just, you know, hiding from the world. I mean, that's kind of where I'm at.
Know if you've read the book, but I talk about the expressives, and it sounds like you might be an expressive. I don't know that, but you might be an empathic expressive, and empathic expressives are, you know, another type of beautiful blending of abilities. And so we need empathic expressive, especially actors or people who are in that creative mode, to help other sensitive people, like the, you know, the psychiatrist or whoever that was in that department who pulled you aside and said, there's nothing wrong with you. You know, we need individuals like that in this movement to help the young people have that same confidence instilled in them at those points of vulnerability when somebody else wants to literally lock them away.
Right. No, yeah, right. I did take the test. I did take the test. Your website is awesome. So I hope it brings a lot of people knowledge and comfort.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you for sharing your story. I think it's really valuable
to
talk about our stories as
David,
sensitive and how we were guided and led. Yeah.
No, it was a true blessing.
It's nice
to
get to meet
you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Come again. Oh, that's really awesome. That's funny you felt the same way. You know, I've been here with the chat room for an hour, and I did not pick up on that at all. And, you know, there's things in the trade we call trolls, and they can be callers or they can be in the chat. And I know them, boom, right? I know them when they show up in the chat and on the switchboard. And those are calls I won't pick up. And I didn't feel that. I felt a very safe chat room tonight. The trolls don't come off, and usually it's around holidays. And I feel sorry for them. They don't have something better to do, you know, than come and harass shows during the holidays.
I'm so grateful that he shared about his experience of the contrast of, you know, his home environment. And so oftentimes, you know, you don't have to necessarily be raised by a sensitive parent, right? Sometimes parents are not helpful when they have a sensitive kid and they really just want you to buck up or buckle down or, you know, keep your head down or whatever the language is to basically, like, you need to adapt and not be who you are, right? Your sensitivity is burdensome or bothersome or tiresome to me, and I want you to be somebody else. And so when we're fed those messages as children, we don't have any other recourse except to internalize those negative words onto ourselves and believe what they mean behind it, which is we're flawed or a bother, or their problems are because we're the bad kid, when in reality, nothing could be further from the truth. Sensitive kids are usually bright, humorous, adaptive. They're tuning in deeply to their parents and finding out what they need, and the kids are usually trying to be that so much. It's not often that you have a kid that's so rebellious that they're trying to antagonize their parents. You know, sensitive kids are just typically very positive, very helpful. So I love that he shared the contrast between how difficult it was being raised by a parent who was forceful, and then the message, the enlightened message of there's nothing wrong with you. Just do what you have to do to get by. I mean, it's torturous for a sensitive kid to have to go through that environment. So I applaud David for doing it and then charting his own course. Yeah. Very difficult.
I do too.
Torturous almost to the psyche to have to be somebody else until you can be free and emancipated to do what you want. I mean, you've already lived a lifetime of torture, essentially, as a sensitive kid.
Yeah, I did that. So I can certainly imagine. I followed a family member into a career, and I acted as if for 25 plus years. And I did go through a dark rebellion because of that. I didn't know that was why, but it was because I wasn't to thine own self be true at all. I was trying to model what other people thought that I should be. And so that didn't end
we
well.
We do it well.
But,
we do it well, usually. You know, we usually do fit into that mold. And we usually become anything and everything that is expected of us so that we can get along or conform and not stand out. I mean, at some point in our emotional, psychological, and adolescent development, what we want to do is what everybody else is saying, hey, this is what we need to do. And so we join in. I think the beautiful thing is, I mean, one of my own opinions is that sensitivity helps us in unimaginable ways to become who we really are, deeply who we really are, and to buck a lot of the conventions because there's something deeper that we're tapping into. And it's unexplainable, you know, like me with the fire or David, you know, finding acting in New York. I mean, it leads you. Sensitivity will lead you to your own passions and truth of who you really are. That's one of my theories. And you just have to trust in yourself and your own wisdom along the way. And that's a hard thing to do, but it works.
Now, we only have 8 minutes, and so that's not very long, but somebody just made a comment, and I clarified it in a sentence.
Okay.
But someone in the chat said that they were told they were sensitive, and it upset them a little bit. And I think, you know, I get that, you know, particularly – you know, gals, there were old stereotypes.
When it's used as a curse word,
then,
it's always used as a pejorative. It's always used as a curse word. You're too sensitive. You're too this, you're too that. And sensitive gets thrown out because it means I don't like the way you're behaving or acting. And so it's negative.
And what
it's a negative association.
Right. And what I told him is that it's positive. It means you're in tune with others and that you care.
Exactly.
A lot of times you see things that other people don't see, and for you who said that, Ron, well, yes, Ben, maybe get, but those are such old stereotypes, you know, things are changing a lot. Yeah, men were never supposed to cry or sweat or do whatever, and women were hysterical and oversensitive, and, you know, those
neurotic,
those, like, yeah, neurotic, you know, those were words that they used to throw out, but in a negative way, meaning something different than what we're talking about here. A sensitive or intuitive is someone who feels things more deeply, has insights that others may not have, and I've seen that in you. I've known you for a long time, Ron, and so the sensitive, if someone was being mean, they were being mean, but in the sense that I've recognized your sensitivity, it's been in a really positive way. There have been times where he's read, because he's been to so many of my shows, you know, I'm from a show must go on kind of family. And so I could have maybe been in tears, you know, a half hour before I came on the show, and boom, it's maybe you do know, you know, I come from, like I said, a half Italian family, and the show must go on, right? That's the point you're on. And
well,
and
there is very real parts of this that are difficult. I mean, I'm not going to lie, and I'm not going to sugarcoat the fact that sensitive people do experience more stress. They do. They see things sometimes, especially in terms of their health, negatively. They are, they do, it's documented, they experience more anxiety. There's a link to depression. I mean, I'm not going to try to make it sound like the sun is always up, okay? Because sensitivity is complex, and it can be deeply disturbing when you're not aware that you're sensitive. But there is a beautiful side to it. And I do believe that if you can acknowledge it and recognize what's happening, especially anxiety, I talk about this in the book, that sensitive people, if they don't know they're sensitive, experience more anxiety because they're perceiving more sensory information in the situation, whether it's with another individual or it's in a room with other people. If they're not aware that they're picking up all this sensory information and it's flooding into them, they have more anxiety. It's been well documented. So if you can understand that, right, and understand that you're perceiving more and your anxiety is connected to it, you can take control of the process and kind of hijack the anxiety cycle, because then you start to recognize, I can control this. And then it becomes about doing therapeutic things that are helpful, positive, beneficial, to take away that negative thought pattern and to hijack it with good, positive stuff that you create, whether that's images like you with your photography, or going into nature and connecting with the animals, or painting, or doing drama like David, and doing art, or growing organic vegetables. I mean, whatever that is for you, you can find it. Your sensitivity will lead you to it, and it will help you heal your own anxiety. Most definitely. That's a bold statement, but I've seen it work.
Nope, it's an absolutely true statement. You have to be open to it, though. And not afraid of it,
and it's
be open to it.
It's an alternative medicine.
And let it
go. Regular medicine, regular medicine, they're going to say, here's an anti-anxiety medicine, you know, Lexapro or Paxil or whatever it is, and they're going to say, this is going to help you with anxiety. And I'm not against pharmaceuticals. Yes, they can help, but you can also help yourself by being assertive and by an inquisitive nature of finding out, well, what's causing this? And sometimes it's a deep conflict.
It is, and I'm not totally putting down the pharmaceuticals either, except I think we're the most overprescribed country in the world. However, I will say, I would even wager to say, and I'm not a doctor, this is just my opinion, that I don't see the pills helping unless you're helping the pills help by doing what we're talking about. A lot of those answers are inside you, and maybe you need the pill to elicit openness for you to be able to find it, but you can work with that medication or you can work against that medication, but the medication ain't going to change your life.
I have an example just briefly. I have a short story from a patient of mine at the clinic that I work at. I work in a very clinical setting, you know, it's corporate wellness, but I had a patient come in and she was asking for family medical leave from her job because she worked at a school and her boss was intimidating. She had no control over her hours. She was given more and more work and very little control over her schedule or her workload. So it was already very highly stress inducing. So she came to the clinic and asked the doctor for family medical leave and she gave it to her. And then she was sent to me for help with anxiety and stress relief. And so she was given a medication for anxiety to help her with her stress and anxiety through the leave. I started working with her right away, very intensively. And do you know, through breathing exercises and guided imagery and mindfulness moments, she never had to take the medication. She took 2 weeks off. She went back on the job, did boundary work, and was able to go into her other work setting without taking meds. And she had extreme anxiety. Extreme stress.
Yeah.
And so that's a success story that I can share that really happened, a real life situation not that long ago. And she did it all herself. I mean, I guided her as a coach because I understood what she needed. But, you know, she didn't have to take the meds and she was happy.
Absolutely.
And so I do think that shows us one, you know, simple example of how you can kind of alter your situation, take a break, take a step back, reorder, do boundary work, do some breathing, open your, you know, mind to the possibilities and see what happens. I mean, what does it hurt, you know, to do good mindfulness practices with anxiety?
Exactly. And try something new. Distract with something new, not something harmful. You know, you talked about not going down the roads of self-medicating and doing, you know, self-harming kind of behaviors. Try something different, like one of the things we found, a lot of people who have had traumatic brain injuries, if they were not, did not consider themselves to be artistic before their injury, suddenly art starts manifesting in some way in their life afterward. And if a person was artistic before they had their injury, they wind up branching out into other places, expanding their artistic ability. In fact, that happens so much. And I hope you guys in the chat can still hear. We're still recording, and this will be in its entirety on the playback. But the clock did stop for some live listeners. Is that we started on Facebook. I'm not there very often, but it's called Disability Art Page. And the only reason we did that is we were sitting here one night talking about art after brain injury and how cathartic various kinds of art were, and that the definition of what it was to be artistic for me was way too narrow, that it's a huge category. You know, there are so many things that are art.
Well, it's one type of sensitivity that I outlined, you know, and I was sharing with when the listener called in, is the expressive. So I go into aesthetic. It's called aesthetic sensitivity. It's one of the subtypes of sensitivity that was found through the research about sensitive people. So aesthetic sensitivity is a very broad term, but it does apply to this all-encompassing feeling of being connected to beauty in the environment, and that's all in the eye of the beholder. And so one of my favorite people who talks about her recovery is Jill Bolte Taylor, and she talks about in her book, My Stroke of Genius, when she had her stroke and she was coming back, she talked about the glass that she used to do. She used to do stained glass as like a hobby or a project. But as she was coming through her recovery, she started to want to work with the glass more and become herself again. And she talked about her right hemisphere as being this perception of life that was so magnificent. She was taking it all in. Obviously, her awareness was so expanded because she couldn't speak or communicate because it was a left hemispheric hemorrhage. But she was able to articulate when she came out through her recovery process the different types of perception of people who are healing through recovery who have had different types of incidences or events neurologically, and how beautiful the right hemispheric translation is of images, color, sounds, and the way it comes in is a very artistic process that the brain uses, and it's translated through the mind's eye. And so I just think that art is so undervalued in our society, not just the expressive artists who are translating those pictures and images or through dance or movement or sound. I mean, it goes on and on and on, but that we've kind of cut it out of education and school systems and have minimized its impact. But in our culture, in our world, in our global societies, art is what helps us see meaning in humanity, in the human experience as we live it. And so I support the artists and the expressives because they're the ones that are able to communicate societal issues and problems and bring them out into the front for everybody to see through their own eye and through their own perception of what beauty is or what it's lacking in the human experience and what we need to do as a society to change that.
Exactly. Well, gosh, this has just been, thank you so much for being here tonight, Courtney. My guest tonight has been Courtney Marchesani, and her book that you want to check out is Four Gifts of the Highly Sensitive, Embrace the Science of Sensitivity, Heal Anxiety and Relationships, and Connect Deeply with Your World. And if you want to take the test we were talking about earlier, check out inspiredpotential.com. The other wellness website is in the program notes, anywhere you might have clicked to listen to the show. And when we get off in just a moment, I'm going to add inspired potential on there for those of you who've been here throughout the show and have heard about the test, so that you don't forget, and it's written there in the program notes if you're not by a pen right now. But thank you so much for coming on. What a pleasure for me to have you here tonight, Courtney. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I love the discussion. I love what you're doing. Keep up the hard work and, you know, straight, keep your arrow straight towards your aims, and you're going to be creating all this beautiful support for those who really need to hear these stories and know that they're okay, just the way they are.
You as well. And thank you, David, Ron, Becky, and those who've been in the chat sending me texts and are listening. You know that I appreciate you all. Have a great week. Good night and God bless. And I'm going to close tonight with Brulé. You can find them, Brulé, BruléRecords.com. And this is the title track off of Night Tree. I just love this rain stick, but it seems appropriate with what we're talking about tonight. So good night and God bless everyone. And this is Night Tree. Good night, Courtney.
Good night.